Now get ready. Albert Taylor joins us in just a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. And we're also going to talk about mirror gazing, an incredible situation. It's an ancient form. We'll be back in a moment with Albert Taylor on Coast to Coast AM. Albert Taylor, let me tell you about him, comes from a structured military and engineering background. He's the last person that anyone would expect to have a long history of OBEs, out-of-body experiences. Further, Al quit his NASA job to write and promote what became, in 1999, the LA Times best-selling book. Al was a crew chief for the ultra-secret U-2 planes earlier in his career as part of the stealth program, and was just recently one of the engineers responsible for some of the designs of the space station. Al is a very high-energy speaker. He uses a lot of humor, direct personal experience to clearly explain the OBE experience. It's a long journey through the concepts of organized religion, superstition, and science will touch you tonight. He's our guest, the author of Soul Travel, right here on Coast to Coast. Hey, Albert, how are you?
Hello, George. It's a pleasure to be here.
Always a pleasure to have you on Coast to Coast, my friend. You are one of those that people always send us little notes about, saying, when's he going to come back?
That's so nice. I really appreciate that.
Tell me a little bit about the military engineering background, and then how in the heck you changed it to the field that we're talking about tonight.
Well, I enlisted in the Air Force at 17 years old. I had my 18th birthday in basic training, by the way, which wasn't fun. They don't give you cake in basic training. And I've always loved things that flew and aircraft and things like that. And I wanted to be involved in jet engine aircraft. Well, luckily, as soon as I got out of tech school, I was transferred right to Davis-Monthan Air Force Base in Arizona, where the U-2s were. And I immediately began working on the U-2s, and I got a secret clearance. And I had the greatest time ever. And then about a year or two later, they transferred us up north to Northern California to join the SR-71s, which were all in the same 9th OMS. And mm-hmm. We kind of worked around. I was working in the SR-71s and with the U-2s. And I mean, I would have done that for free, and just it was so much fun. It was the most incredible thing I've ever done. But having all that work since the U-2 was and so was the SR-71 was designed by Lockheed Skunk Works. As soon as I got out of the military, they snatched me up to work on the stealth fighter program in Burbank, and I got a chance to work on that for the very first one, as a matter of fact, the very first flyable stealth fighter. And then from that point on, I wanted to. President Carter.
70s.
Yeah, late 70s, early 80s.
President early 80s would have given you Reagan.
President Carter canceled it, the B-1 bomber.
Yeah.
And then President Reagan re-energized it with the B-1B. And luckily, I was leaving the stealth fighter at that time, and I got a job on the B-1B, designing flight controls and the rotary launch system for nuclear cruise missiles.
My God, what a career, Robert.
Yeah, it was fantastic working on that program, too. And then I love things that fly, and I love space things. So an opening came up in the Strategic Defense Initiative, which President Reagan had initiated and got going. So I applied for it, and I got a chance to transfer over to a very black program, the Star Wars program that they called it, mm-hmm. to the layman. I worked on the particle beam, just incredible stuff that you just didn't think existed.
Do you believe that technology now, Albert, is going full boat, or do you think we stopped it?
Well, no, I don't think we stopped it at all. It's just gone underground.
That's what I thought.
It's the matter of fact, what's so interesting about black programs is they don't have to report to Congress or anything. There's so much money going into black programs, the technology. You can't stop it. First of all, the threats and the way the world is today, you have to have something like that to protect us.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Chinese, I'm going to be talking about this with Charles Ostman on Thursday. But, the Chinese just destroyed one of their satellites in mm-hmm. a test. They've got the technology. But I got to believe, Albert, we've got technology way beyond theirs.
Oh, yeah. Just amazing stuff. And this was back in 86 that I was doing this. So you can imagine that, that was a long time ago, 20 years ago. So the technology that we have now is probably just astronomical. Usually, On all of the programs that I've ever worked on, we were at least 40 to 50 years in the future in advance of anybody else.
Okay, I've got to ask you this, Albert. Any of it reverse engineered from UFO or extraterrestrial technology, or did it ever come across your desk, or did your friends talk about that?
Well, I can say this because they never, you know, everything is so compartmentalized.
Yes.
And you have to have a need to know everything. But I can say this. I did work on an optical system, and I won't go into too much detail on it, that was so advanced, and it was nothing like we ever used and nothing like has ever been created that we used, and it was part of the one of the programs that I did work on. And it was really funny because the system failed, and I was picked to escort it to the one of the subcontractors that was working on it, and we disguised it as this simple device. And I have to tell you, George, of course they alerted the airlines at the time.
Who made it, by the way?
When, you know, one of the subcontractors in Indianapolis.
I mean, it wasn't made up there, was it?
I'm not sure where it originated.
Okay.
I just know we were using it.
All right.
I had to escort this thing in a box and through the airport. Of course, the airport was alerted to it. And you should have seen the face of the screener who was looking at the X-ray machine.
Right.
When that thing went through the machine, it was the funniest thing. She stopped the machine and said, "Oh, my God, what is that?"
Yeah, there's no way she was going to let that through. How did you get it through?
I had paperwork
that
stated, you know, certain
that it was official.
Priority.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she just looked at it, and she said, "What is that?" And I gave her the paperwork, and then she said, "Okay." And I carried it with me. I never left my sight. I sat in first class. It had its own seat. I strapped it into the seat.
How heavy was it?
It was about half the size of a man.
Okay.
And I strapped it into the seat, the flight attendant came by, and she served me a drink, and I served the drink for the seat that was next to me.
I was going to say, it didn't order, did it?
No, it didn't order, but it ended up getting two drinks, which was kind of strange.
Okay, so here you are. You're an engineer scientist. You've done some work now in the International Space Station. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got a very varied background in science. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, I mean, you start wanting to write a book on out-of-the-body experiences. You want to investigate the paranormal. What the heck happened to you?
Well, you know, it wasn't really all of a sudden. What happened was, in the back, you know, I kind of led a dual life. Part of it, as far as my career, was in hardcore science and engineering.
Mm-hmm.
But my personal life, ever since I was 5 years old, I had paranormal happenings to me,
uh-huh.
Things that I kept quiet. I didn't tell anybody because, I mean, I was investigated by the Department of Defense, the FBI, and all this background checking. The last thing I was going to tell them is, yeah, I leave my body and I fly out and ghosts and dead people come see me all the time. I was going to say.
Yeah, you'd be high on their list to hire after that, wouldn't
never,
you?
I worked on a system on Air Force One that protects the president from heat-seeking missiles. I never would have gotten close to that device.
God. You should have seen my interview for Coast to Coast, Albert. I told them all this, but they loved it. That's what got me the job.
So they never would have let me get close to any of the programs that I got a chance to enjoy if I would have told them about my personal life, which began at the age of 5, where I remember one night, like it was yesterday, I was asleep, and I heard someone calling my name. And slowly I woke up, and I opened my eyes, and there was this transparent humanoid image sitting on the edge of my bed calling my name. And I have to tell you, I was terrified at 5 years old. And all I could think about, and I was also paralyzed, and I couldn't move.
Sure it wasn't a dream?
I'm positive.
All right.
Because I struggled and struggled and struggled, and finally I could move, and it still was there. And all I could think about was trying to get between, it was in between me and the door. And I literally jumped off the bed and went right through it and went out the door, and I ran down the hallway into my grandmother's room, who was staying with us at the time. And I woke her up. It's like 3 o'clock in the morning. I woke her up and said, "Grandma, there was this thing on my bed, and it was calling my name, and I couldn't move." And my grandmother looked at me. She was kind of sleepy-eyed, and she said, "Oh, that's okay. It was a wish that came to steal your soul because you were bad today."
Whoa, just what you need to hear at 5 years old, right?
Yeah, thanks
Grandma.
For that, Grandma.
Yeah.
I can really go back to sleep now. So that was the beginning of this whole thing. I never imagined that it would end up being such a huge part of my life.
And it has. It has steered you in the direction that you're going now. So you Now, when you decided to quit NASA, right, mm-hmm. you were working on the space station at the time?
Right. The airlock was mine. The pressurized mating adapter that the shuttle docks to was mine.
Well, those things work well, oh, so congratulations on that. That may be the only two things that do work on that thing.
Yeah, so far, I don't think they're able to leave the space station and go outside, which is that was my airlock. And the shuttle has been able to dock without any problems, and that was mine. So far, I guess I've done a pretty good job.
Albert, why did they build the thing?
Well, see, that's so complex. The original plan, George, was amazing. The vehicle could do so many things. It was a way station between here and Mars. So we would build a spacecraft in orbit and launch it to a lunar base and then launch it to Mars. It could do so many things.
See, they never told us that.
Right. Well, that was in the very beginning. There's concept pictures of it that were just amazing. And then what happened was Clinton was elected. And Clinton said, well, it cost too much money. I think it was $8 billion at the time. And he said, it costs way too much money. You're going to have to redesign and bring the cost down. Well, we had already had international partners, Japanese and all these people, mm-hmm. European and all that,
the Russians,
who had already finalized designs. Now we're telling them to go back to the drawing board and redesign this thing. Well, instead of saving money, it ended up costing $32 billion. And
typical
it had
government.
Less capability. So it was a fiasco. The whole space station is a fiasco. It was never meant to be what it is now, which is very, very little. And now we're stuck with the space station that can't do anything, and a shuttle that has catastrophic failures, kills people, and can only go 300 miles above the Earth.
How did you decide to quit?
Well,
and how did you tell them?
Well, the episodes of night paralysis and visitations and leaving my body all of a sudden went from happening once or twice a month to several times a week, and then sometimes several times a night. So it got my attention.
Yeah.
I thought I was going crazy, George. I went to a psychiatrist. I went to a neurologist. I really was looking for a physical abnormality that I could possibly get a pill for.
Did you get a brain scan just to make sure you didn't
have a tumor? Brain scan. I got the full workup of so much. And I got an MRI and just you name it. And I got a clean bill of health. Well, these episodes were still happening. So I began to just document it, you know, because I'm a scientist and we do research. I figured, okay, it's happening. Let me try to document it as much as I possibly can. One of the reasons was I thought, well, if I do go crazy and, you know, and they find this diary laying next to me, they can read it and figure out why I'm sitting in the corner drooling. That's what I was thinking. So I had no idea that diary, because I still have the penciled version, would end up becoming a book, and I had no idea that book would end up becoming a number one Times bestseller. That did not cross my mind at all.
And when you quit, did you think, I'm walking out of this? Because I'm sure it paid you a pretty good penny, didn't it?
Yeah, oh, definitely. I was very comfortable.
How much did you make?
I was in six figures. And I used to, my motto was, and I had a hat that said, he who dies with the most toys wins. I was very comfortable.
Nice house,
nice cars. I was doing very well, very well.
Can you get me on the International Space Station?
the things you don't want to get, the program is so changed.
So you gave that up?
Yes, I did.
That's gutsy.
Yeah, well, it was scary as hell. It was probably the scariest thing I've ever done because I've been in aerospace so long. I didn't consider myself a writer, but spiritually, this impacted me so much that I had to do something. As a matter of fact, I tell people I had to do this or a part of me would have died inside.
What did your colleagues tell you at the time?
They told me I was crazy. Some of them would even avoid me. I'd be walking down the hallway, and I'd see them coming, friends and secretaries, and they'd see me coming and move to the other side of the hallway and pass me by without speaking. One lady walked up to me and said, I can't talk to you anymore. My husband said I can't speak to you anymore because of what you're doing and what you're writing. So it was not easy. I was an outcast, so to speak. But because of the incredible spiritual experiences that I had, which were the ultimate truth to me, I had to do it, even if I failed.
How many experiences occurred before you wrote Soul Traveler?
Oh, wow. 70, maybe.
Okay. Okay, so
many.
It was a buildup.
Oh, yes. And they weren't separate. They were adding to my knowledge. I was experimenting, getting better at it, seeing things that I repeatedly, which is, you know, important for a researcher.
Did you find that the more paranormal experiences you had, Albert, the more tuned in you became, the more intuitive you became?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. And, you know, one of the things I still try to stay away from is that psychic word. I use Intuitive or Insights. I began to sense things about people. I began to help them with their problems, which I never was a counselor of any sort at all. And as a matter of fact, my ex used to tell me, I don't know, something's happened to you. You're becoming some kind of guru or something. But I wasn't trying to be. But it was having a profound change on me, and it changed me into somebody else. I'm not the same person I used to be.
When all this was going on, at any point, because we're going to talk about your profound OBE experiences and things like that, but at any point, were you witnessing evil entities or anything like that?
Evil. I wouldn't use that word. I'd say entities that didn't have my best interest at heart. They were pushing me around.
Why won't you use evil?
Because I don't think of it that way. I think people, I don't think you change a lot just because you die. I think if you're a bad person, that doesn't make you evil. You're not a nice person. If you're a good person, you're a good person. Evil, to me, almost has a little bit of a religious tone to it. And I'd say that some of them were not nice entities. They probably weren't nice people.
Now, did they come later on, or was it ongoing?
It was periodic.
From the get-go?
One of the things about pain is if you believe you can feel pain, you can, and it's excruciating.
True.
And I had one of those episodes where something was causing me pain. Something bit me. But there was no physical traces, but that was in the experience. But slowly but surely, I realized that I wasn't a victim. I was on the same level as them, and I had even more leverage than they did. So when I became aware to that, the negative situations began to decrease and pretty much are non-existent. I haven't had one in at least a decade.
Well, that's pretty good.
Yeah, and that's what I share with people. It's about empowerment. It's about, you know, if you're fearful, which is the worst thing you could possibly be, you're going to attract things to you, and you're going to experience. And it's kind of like, you know, I remember I used to go jogging, and I passed by a neighbor's house, and they had this dog sitting out in front of the house. And as I passed by, he began to chase me. And as long as I ran, he would chase me. But if I turned around and stopped and confronted the dog would tuck his tail between his legs and go running back to the house. Well, that's kind of how it is on the other side. If you run, you're going to be chased. If you think you can feel pain, you're going to get pain inflicted upon you. But if you feel empowered and strong, then they're not going to bother with you because it's a waste of time.
It happens in life too, Albert, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
And just about anything you do, when you least expect it, that's when it begins to show up. The OBE,
George, that we don't change that much on the other side. We're kind of the same human souls that we are here in the physical body on the other side.
Can you do an OBE at will now, or does
still,
it just...
I'm about 70-80%, which means 7 times out of 10 I'm successful.
That's, you know, pretty good. I can't. I had one when I was 11 or 12. Mm-hmm. Never been able to repeat it. Can't do it.
I have had such. I teach an ongoing class. It's called Spiritual Evolution Through Out-of-Body Experiences. I have had phenomenal results with my students who have never had experiences, who are having experiences now. I'm so pleased with the techniques that I've developed.
All right, well, stick with us, Albert. We're here at the half, and then when we come back, we'll talk about your OBE experiences and much more as we talk about psychics and spiritual attacks. Albert Taylor's our special guest. His book, very good book indeed, called Soul Traveler. We've got two websites for him linked up, alberttaylor.com, haunted911.com as well. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I want to tell you about the After Dark newsletter. A couple things. First of all, you'll still get, those of you who are new as well, will get the double CDs, the old Art Bell interviews with the late Father Malachi Martin. Classics. Absolute classics. So call 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. However, this is the last week that you'll get the January issue of the After Dark newsletter, which is the predictions issue. So if you're interested in that, you'll get the CDs when you order this week or next week, whenever you want to do that, until that campaign ends. But this is the last week to pick up the predictions issue, which will be the first one you get with the After Dark newsletter. So again, call 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. Next hour, we'll talk with Albert about mirror gazing. It's been popularized by the late Dr. Raymond Moody, and we will talk about that. It's called psychomantium, isn't it, Albert?
Yes, it is.
Okay, we'll get into that. Now, tell me about your most unbelievable, profound OBE that you've ever had so far that you can remember.
Okay, but George, can I first say I did read your book, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Well, thank you.
And I want to thank you for mentioning me in the book.
You are welcome. You deserve it.
And I, even though you used to call me Alfred, I'll take it.
Yeah, well, that wasn't me. The publisher missed that one.
That's okay. Any mention is a good mention.
Well, we got Taylor right.
Yes, you did.
All right.
Close enough. Close enough. I think my most profound, and it wasn't toward the beginning. It was somewhere after about 60, I'd say, was... And I have to say, I wasn't looking for any spiritual enlightenment or God or anything like that. I was very skeptical, as a matter of fact. I thought we just had these bodies. I wasn't thinking we had a soul. And when the bodies failed and ceased to function, we ceased to exist. That's what I believed. The most profound one was that I felt the vibration like I would normally feel. I felt paralyzed, and I began to float upward. All of a sudden, I could see the room without opening my eyes. One thing was strange about seeing the room is I normally wear glasses, but the room was extremely clear and very focused, mm-hmm. which I noticed right away. Everything in the room had its own glow to it. It wasn't directional. Everything seemed to radiate, which was interesting. And there was this buzzing, like electrical charge throughout the entire room, or maybe it was just me, just like that. And then all of a sudden, this is the best way I can describe it. It felt like something opened up my consciousness and my awareness and poured all the answers to life in it at once. For that brief period of time, I had no questions about anything, and I remembered things that I didn't know in this life. I knew about my life before being Albert. I knew about why I was here, why we are here. I mean, just so profound. And the one thing that I got out of that is that I felt that that was my natural state of existence, that being in the physical body was snuffing that out or hiding that. But that's where we came from, and that's where we'll go back to. And another thing that happened is when I finally, it was so incredibly overwhelming that I wanted to go back to my physical body. And when I did, I finally reconnected and I opened my eyes. And the euphoric feeling that I had, I couldn't control it, where tears just rushed out of my eyes into the pillow. And I was so happy and content knowing that there's something more than what I thought. And from that point on, I have to say that the fear of death completely left me, because I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt, and it had nothing to do with teachings or readings or anything, because I was raised Catholic, but I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that I would exist beyond my physical body.
You know, it is probably incredible how many people have had OBEs on this planet, either on a regular basis or maybe even a one-time. But the calls that keep coming in, Albert, it is absolutely staggering.
I'm already, since you just put me on the website, I'm being bombarded by people sharing their stories with me.
Yeah.
I believe that even the people, some people, I'd say maybe a 40% know that they're having an out-of-body experience, but then there's another 40% or so that aren't aware of what's happening to them, and they are having one.
They may think it's a dream, right?
A dream,
or something else.
Disqualify it, or a hallucination of some sort, or something like that. But what happens is the people who have come to my lectures and things like that, what I do is I share some of the symptoms and things that are happening to them, and they say, "How did you know that?" Well, the reason I know that is because it's an out-of-body experience, and it enlightens them, and they become aware that, oh, my God, I did have that. And one of the things for anybody out there, if you have any doubts, one of the things that separates the OBE from a dream is that a dream you don't think about the rest of your life. One out-of-body experience you will never, ever forget.
So true. A couple years ago, two Englishmen wrote a book called The Projection of the Astral Body, Hayward Carrington, Sylvan Muldoon. And they claim that you go through different stages or levels of planes of existence in an OBE, but they said some of these areas you didn't want to stay and hang around.
Yes, very
it was
true.
Very frightening to
very
them.
True. It's, you know, consider, think of it as like, you know, there's some parts of LA that are really wonderful,
right?
And then there's some parts that aren't, you know, are very bad neighborhoods.
True.
It's kind of like that. At the very low levels of the astral plane, if you want to call it that, focus level one, whatever you know, you believe your belief system dictates. At the very lowest level, that's where all the obsessions are, the people who are obsessed with gambling, drugs, and all that stuff. So anger and all kinds of negative emotions are at that level. You don't want to hang around that level. But unfortunately, all of us, when we first leave our physical bodies, that's where we are. You don't have to stay there, but that's where you are. So if you hang around there, you know, some negative things can happen to you. So definitely you want to try to move as high as possible.
If you're out of your body, and you're in one of these planes, I'll call it evil, you won't, but one of these planes, can your body get possessed, taken over?
No. That's one of the
fallacies?
Myths, yes, that someone believes that your body can, you know, you know, when you come back, someone else will be occupying it. It'll be moving
if
around
you
the
can,
room.
If you can come
There'll
back.
Be a new driver. No, that's not true. There is divine order going on. I'm not going to say from a god in a nightshirt, you know, or something like that, old guy with a beard and a nightshirt, but there is a divine order that's given you your body for this earthly experience, and you're going to have that body for the duration. It's not going to be used by somebody else.
You promise?
Against your will.
Promise?
I've never had a problem with that. I don't even know anybody who has full-blown, controlled, out-of-body experiences who ever even talked about that.
You do believe in possession, though.
I can't say I believe or disbelieve. I've investigated some things like that.
Well, what about exorcisms and things like that?
This is the mind is so incredible that we are capable of manifesting paranormal energy or psychic energy or a telekinetic-like energy. Sometimes, especially like when when they talk about poltergeist, it's not like the movie that we saw where it was a separate entity kind of thing. Poltergeist activity is usually generated from the individual, and it can run amok. So that kind of thing, you know, you'd have to investigate. I don't want to paint with a broad brush. But generally, out of all the cases that I've investigated, there's been some kind of trail or some kind of thing that leads it back to the individual that they may be generating that negativity. Of course, there are some issues. I mean, I can't say it absolute. I have seen some external things attacking people. But generally, when you have something like that, it can be categorized as poltergeist-like activity.
Well, what happens when we open these phone lines later on tonight, Albert, and you start getting calls from people who say, well, I was attacked.
I believe that. I'm not saying 100%. I have investigated 7 cases of attacks, some of them physical, some of them sexual. I have another 4 cases that we haven't gotten to. So I do believe that some people are being attacked by something. We don't know exactly what. I've followed Dr. Barry Taft's investigation of the entity very carefully, which was back in, I think, the early 70s or 80s in Culver City, and a movie was made from that particular investigation. I thought that was a very isolated situation.
Yeah, that movie was called Entity.
Yes, exactly. I thought it was a very isolated case, but here after doing paranormal investigation with my group PRI for about 4 or 5 years now, and this being the 7th case that we've done, and there's 3 more or 4 more waiting in the wings, I no longer feel that it is isolated.
And when you say we have done, you have founded your own paranormal research group, right?
Exactly. I have about 30 investigators. Various talents and skills, some scientists from Cornell University and a few other places. We're doing extensive research. We've joined the Institute of Noetic Sciences.
Yes, that's Edgar Mitchell's group. Okay.
Uh-huh. We're working under the umbrella of the nature of human consciousness, because in the body or out is still human consciousness. So,
what's the name of your group?
My group is Paranormal Research Investigations.
Okay.
And I don't want to say that we're just ghost hunters, because we're not. We do that and a lot more. So, but in the course of that, we've investigated so many different types of phenomena that is slowly educating us as to what's going on outside of the body and all around us in everyday life.
What are you able to conclude at this point, then, about that other side?
Well, I think, well, I have to be almost schizophrenic here, George, because I have to I have to push my belief and my experiences of OBE stuff to the side.
All right.
And say, okay, data. Now, clear data. What have I gathered?
This is the scientist part of you coming out now.
Exactly. So now I have data that where I have language on it. I have English language that something, it was, there was nothing physical there. It was interactive, meaning that it responded to me. I asked questions, and it answered my questions. I recorded all this. I have video, digital video of something gaseous, humanoid, semi-humanoid shaped, moving through walls. So you start putting all these pieces together, it starts leading you to a conclusion. I don't think it was a parrot or a minor bird that was talking to me. It slowly leads you to that possibly this was some type of disembodied, conscious, interactive entity of some sort. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the jury's still out. I don't want to, you know, I'm still a scientist. I don't want to say, yes, it's a ghost. I never say that. I let the data speak for itself, but I would say definitely that there is some type of interactive, separate consciousness that we've been able to interact with, and that's around us in a lot of cases.
So you've got about 30 researchers all over the country or just in certain areas?
All of us are stationed here, are based here in Anaheim at a foundation in Anaheim called the Learning Life Foundation. We work under their umbrella.
Who are they?
It's probably the oldest metaphysical facility in Southern California, or maybe even in the western part of the United States.
Okay.
There's 50, I think about 50 years old. Originally, they were put together by a bunch of people who were like, for lack of a better term, New Age-like. But as I came into it, one of the things I thought it lacked was true investigation of the paranormal and all the things that they were talking about. They were doing
in a scientific way.
Yeah. They were doing spirit circles and things like that. But I really thought let's really get some hardcore science going on here and start documenting the data and
right.
do some research on it. So that's when I opened up the wing about 5 years ago, and they've been so supportive on buying us equipment and having setting up appointments and taking messages and all that things where we can actually function and go out and do paranormal investigation that I call paranormal crisis management. And the reason I call it that is because people call us who are traumatized by their paranormal experiences, and we try to manage it and empower them and help them transition through the negative to the positive.
Our friend Joshua Warren has a new computer that is just incredible for picking up signals from the other side.
Is that a Spiricom?
No, it's not a Spiricom.
Okay.
It's a paranormal computer with some incredible software
mm-hmm.
that just reads. It's got just a different read with infrared, and it picks up vibrations and sound. He had it out at the Haunted Queen Mary
mm-hmm.
a couple months ago where I did a program.
Right.
And he took it out into a haunted area. There was so much energy out there, Albert, it zapped the computer and the batteries died.
Oh,
and then he was able to try it again. But it's incredible. You two need to get together.
Yeah, I did read his book, and I found it very, very fascinating. And I kind of use a lot of it to in some of the PRI stuff that we do. And I've seen some of his other work on a video that he did with Alone in the Haunted House. So it was very fascinating.
Tell me about some of your other paranormal investigations.
One of the most startling ones is, and I the pictures are on our Haunted 911 website. We got a call from a lady in Lancaster. She said that her daughter was being attacked physically by something unseen. Okay, I have to tell you, George, that I'm very skeptical when people call me.
Okay.
Because more times than not, it's some type of other thing, like a mental instability, you know.
Well, you got to check it all.
Yeah,
right?
Definitely. So we, you know, because another paranormal investigator was allegedly there and was so traumatized by what he had witnessed that he refused to come back there, that led me to think, and I spoke to him, that led me to think, okay, well, what's going on here? So we drove out there, and while I began, you know, I have a females on my team, right? So since it was a little girl, about 14 years old, who was being attacked. What I did is I had one of my female investigators follow her around to make sure that she wasn't scratching herself, because for all I know, she could be trying to get attention.
Very possible.
She
absolutely.
Could be trying to get attention.
You know, and some kids cut themselves.
Right, exactly. So I don't know. So my female investigator followed her everywhere she went, and I took the mother outside of the environment, and I began to interview her. And she began to tell me what was going on, and she also began to share that she, too, was being attacked by something. And she showed me, she said it threw her in the teeth into the television, and she showed me a scar. And I don't know, I wasn't there, but I looked at the scar. While I was interviewing her, all of a sudden I heard my investigator, scream, ow, ow, quick, you've got to get in here. So I grab my camera and I go running into the house and into the bedroom where the little girl and about four other team members are. And she said she pulls up her blouse and shows her bare back and her stomach and her leg and says, "It's starting to burn. Something's scratching me. Now I'm looking at it and I have the camera running. I don't see anything right away. But slowly but surely, red marks, like three-fingered red marks, like a claw kind of thing, began to appear. And they slowly raise up and they begin to welt. And then eventually they began to bleed. And now I'm watching this thinking, well, what's going on here?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then this is the part that really I thought was amazing, is the scratches no longer were random. They began to scratch symbols into her back and then to her leg. And I have pictures on the website where you'll see on her thigh is one symbol and the inverse of the same symbol is on her side. It was amazing. Mm. That's impossible. That's not something that can randomly, mistakenly happen.
Then what do you deduce by this?
Well, we got some very strange EMF readings in the one particular area. And as a matter of fact, they told me that this thing is around this closet area. It's a four-bedroom house. I told them, don't tell me which closet it is. We're going to just go through the house and see what we can find.
Right.
So we just happened to go into this one room where there was EMF readings that we could not explain. We looked for wiring. We looked for all kinds of sources. We could not find any. And then it was verified that, yes, that is the room that this thing allegedly happens in. And it just so happened that the girl, that happened to be the girl's bedroom. Well, before, what we do is, this is something I don't quite understand, but we do it. I allow my team to do it because it seems to work. It works about 8 out of 10 times. I allow them to do what's called a clearing. And it's kind of prayer, and it's a little bit of sage, and they walk around the house doing kind of a ritualistic thing. I don't mm-hmm. understand it. I'm not a part of that.
It works,
but
in
it
some
works.
Cases, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't care. My priority is to help the people, and I don't have to understand it as long as it helps. And so they did a clearing around the house, but fortunately what happened was the girl decided to move away from Lancaster and to move into the house with her father in Downey, and the paranormal occurrences ceased to happen.
Now,
I don't know
if
it will happen if she went back to the house, but it ceased. It wasn't happening at her father's house, only in this particular house in Lancaster.
Now, you've picked up some EVP sounds
yes.
as well, right?
Yes, we have.
Now, we're approaching the top of the hour. What are the odds of you being able to get them and play them near your phone next hour?
I will look for them.
Okay.
I will definitely look. And if not, they are on the website also, but I will definitely look for them.
Now, what of your two sites, which one do you have on there?
Haunted 911, and it has EVPs on there, and you can listen to them.
Okay. All right. Very good. Albert, if people want to email you, what do they do?
The best thing to do, you can email me from the site where it says contact us, or you can email me from my site, from my email, soltrav, as in Victor, ler@aol.com. It's the same one I've had for 10, 11 years.
Okay, Albert. Well, I tell you what, this next hour, I can't believe this hour has gone by so quickly. I want to talk about this mirror gazing
okay.
called psychomantium.
Right.
Who invented that word?
It was originally developed by the oracles of Delphi in the Roman times, I think 400 AD.
Okay, we'll have you explain that, and we'll talk much more about psychic attacks as well. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.